Chapter 38. Fallen state, were the aspect and guise of my brother. Carwin did not fail to recognize the visitant. Care for his own safety was apparently swallowed up in the amazement which this spectacle produced. His station was conspicuous, and he could not have escaped the roving glances of Wyland, yet the latter seemed totally unconscious of his presence. Grief at this scene of ruin and blast was at first the only sentiment of which I was conscious. A fearful stillness ensued. At length Wyland, lifting his hands, which were locked in each other, to his breast, exclaimed, "Father, I thank thee. This is thy guidance. Hither thou hast led me, that I might perform thy will. Yet let me not err. Let me hear again thy messenger." He stood for a minute as if listening. But, recovering from his attitude, he continued, "It is not needed. Dastardly wretch, thus eternally questioning the behests of thy maker, weak in resolution, wayward in faith." He advanced to me, and, after another pause, resumed, "Poor girl, a dismal fate has set its mark upon thee. Thy life is demanded as a sacrifice. Prepare thee to die. Make not my office difficult by fruitless opposition. Thy prayers might subdue stones, but none but he who enjoined my purpose can shake it." These words were a sufficient explication of the scene. The nature of his frenzy, as described by my uncle, was remembered. I, who had sought death, was now thrilled with horror, because it was near. Death in this form, death from the hand of a brother, was thought upon with indescribable repugnance. In a state thus verging upon madness, my eye glanced upon Carwin. His astonishment appeared to have struck him motionless and dumb. My life was in danger, and my brother's age, and was about to be imbrued in my blood. I firmly believed that Carwin's was the instigation. I could rescue myself from this abhorred fate. I could dissipate this tremendous illusion. I could save my brother from the perpetration of new horrors, by pointing out the devil who seduced him. To hesitate a moment was to perish. These thoughts gave strength to my limbs and energy to my accents. I started on my feet. "Oh, brother! Spare me! Spare thyself! There is thy betrayer!" He counterfeited the voice and face of an angel, for the purpose of destroying thee and me. He has this moment confessed it. He is able to speak where he is not. He is leagued with hell, but will not avow it. Yet he confesses that the agency was his. My brother turned slowly his eyes, and fixed them upon Carwin. Every joint in the frame of the latter trembled. His complexion was paler than a ghost's. His eye dared not meet that of Wyland, but wandered with an air of distraction from one space to another. "Man," said my brother, in a voice totally unlike that which he had used to me, "what art thou? The charge has been made. Answer it." The visage, the voice at the bottom of these stairs at the hour of 11, to whom did they belong? To thee? Twice did Carwin attempt to speak, but his words died away upon his lips. My brother resumed, in a tone of greater vehemence. "Thou falterest. Faltering is ominous. Say yes or no, one word will suffice, but beware of falsehood. Was it a stratagem of hell to overthrow my family? Wast thou the agent?" I now saw that the wrath which had been prepared for me was to be heaped upon another. The tale that I heard from him, and his present trepidations, were abundant testimonies of his guilt. But what if Wyland should be undeceived? What if he shall find his act to have proceeded not from a heavenly prompter, but from human treachery? Will not his rage mount into whirlwind? Will not he tear limb from limb this devoted wretch? Instinctively I recoiled from this image, but it gave place to another. Carwin may be innocent, but the impetuosity of his judge may misconstrue his answers into a confession of guilt. Wyland knows not that mysterious voices and appearances were likewise witnessed by me. Carwin may be ignorant of those which misled my brother. Thus may his answers unwarily betray himself to ruin. Such might be the consequences of my frantic precipitation, and these it was necessary, if possible, to prevent. I attempted to speak, but Wieland, turning suddenly upon me, commanded silence, in a tone furious and terrible. My lips closed, and my tongue refused its office. "What art thou?" he resumed, addressing himself to Carwin. "Swear me. Whose form, whose voice, was it thy contrivance? Answer me." The answer was now given, but confusedly and scarcely articulated. "I meant nothing," I intended. "No ill if I understand, if I do not mistake you, it is too true I did appear in the entry did speak. The contrivance was mine, but these words were no sooner uttered, than my brother ceased to wear the same aspect. His eyes were downcast, he was motionless, his respiration became hoarse, like that of a man in the agonies of death. Carwin seemed unable to say more. He might have easily escaped, but the thought which occupied him related to what was horrid and unintelligible in this scene, and not to his own danger. Presently the faculties of Wieland, which, for a time, were chained up, were seized with restlessness and trembling. He broke silence. The stoutest heart would have been appalled by the tone in which he spoke. He addressed himself to Carwin. "Why art thou here? Who detains thee? Go and learn better. I will meet thee, but it must be at the bar of thy maker. There shall I bear witness against thee." Perceiving that Carwin did not obey, he continued, "Dost thou wish me to complete the catalogue by thy death? Thy life is a worthless thing. Tempt me no more. I am but a man, and thy presence may awaken a fury which may spurn my control. Beckon." Carwin, irresolute, striving in vain for utterance, his complexion pallid as death, his knees beating one against another, slowly obeyed the mandate and withdrew. 2. A few words more, and I lay aside the pen forever. Yet why should I not relinquish it now? All that I have said is preparatory to this scene, and my fingers, tremulous and cold as my heart, refuse any further exertion. This must not be. Let my last energy support me in the finishing of this task. Then will I lay down my head in the lap of death. Hushed will be all my murmurs in the sleep of the grave. Every sentiment has perished in my bosom. Even friendship is extinct. Your love for me has prompted me to this task, but I would not have complied, if it had not been a luxury thus, to feast upon my woes. I have justly calculated upon my remnant of strength. When I lay down the pen, the taper of life will expire, my existence will terminate with my tale. Now that I was left alone with Wieland, the perils of my situation presented themselves to my mind. That this paroxysm should terminate in havoc and rage it was reasonable to predict. The first suggestion of my fears had been disproved by my experience. Carwin had acknowledged his offenses, and yet had escaped. The vengeance which I had harbored had not been admitted by Wieland, and yet the evils which I had endured, compared with those inflicted on my brother, were as nothing. I thirsted for his blood, and was tormented with an insatiable appetite for his destruction. But my brother was unmoved, and had dismissed him in safety. Surely thou wast more than man, while I am sunk below the beasts. Did I place a right construction on the conduct of Wieland? Was the error that misled him so easily rectified? Were views so vivid, and faith so strenuous thus liable to fading and to change? Was there not reason to doubt the accuracy of my perceptions? With images like these was my mind thronged, till the deportment of my brother called away my attention. I saw his lips move and his eyes cast up to heaven. Then would he listen and look back, as if in expectation of someone's appearance. Thrice he repeated these gesticulations and this inaudible prayer. Each time the mist of confusion and doubt seemed to grow darker, and to settle on his understanding. I guessed at the meaning of these tokens. The words of Carwin had shaken his belief, and he was employed in summoning the messenger who had formerly communed with him, to attest the value of those new doubts. In vain the summons was repeated, for his eye met nothing but vacancy, and not a sound saluted his ear. He walked to the bed, gazed with eagerness at the pillow which had sustained the head of the breathless Catherine, and then returned to the place where I sat. I had no power to lift my eyes to his face. I was dubious of his purpose, this purpose my name and my life. Alas! Nothing but subjection to danger and exposure to temptation can show us what we are. By this test was I now tried, and found to be cowardly and rash. Men can deliberately untie the thread of life, and of this, I had deemed myself capable. It was now that I stood upon the brink of fate, that the knife of the sacrificer was aimed at my heart. I shuddered, and betook myself to any means of escape, however monstrous. Can I bear to think, can I endure to relate the outrage which my heart meditated? Where were my means of safety? Resistance was vain. Not even the energy of despair could set me on a level with that strength which his terrific prompter had bestowed upon Wieland. Terror enables us to perform incredible feats, but terror was not then the state of my mind. Where then were my hopes of rescue? Methinks it is too much. I stand aside, as it were, from myself. I estimate my own deservings. A hatred, immortal and inexorable, is my due. I listen to my own pleas, and find them empty and false. Yes, I acknowledge that my guilt surpasses that of mankind. I confess that the curses of a world, and the frowns of a deity, are inadequate to my demerits. Is there a thing in the world worthy of infinite abhorrence? It is I, what shall I say? I was menaced, as I thought, with death, and, to elude this evil, my H hand was ready to inflict death upon the menacer. In visiting my house, I had made provision against the machinations of Carwin. In a fold of my dress an open penknife was concealed. This I now seized and drew forth. It lurked out of view, but I now see that my state of mind would have rendered the deed inevitable if my brother had lifted his hand. This instrument of my preservation would have been plunged into his heart. Oh, insupportable remembrance! Hide thee from my view for a time. Hide it from me that my heart was black enough to meditate the stabbing of a brother. A brother thus supreme in misery, thus towering in virtue. He was probably unconscious of my design, but presently drew back. This interval was sufficient to restore me to myself. The madness, the iniquity, of that act which I had purposed rushed upon my apprehension. For a moment I was breathless with agony. At the next moment I recovered my strength, and threw the knife with violence on the floor. The sound awoke my brother from his reverie. He gazed alternately at me, and at the weapon. With a movement equally solemn he stooped and took it up. He placed the blade in different positions, scrutinizing it accurately, and maintaining, at the same time, a profound silence. Again he looked at me. But all that vehemence and loftiness of spirit which had so lately characterized his features were flown. Fallen muscles, a forehead contracted in two folds, eyes dim with unbidden drops, and a ruefulness of aspect which no words can describe, were now visible. His looks touched into energy the same sympathies in me, and I poured forth a flood of tears. This passion was quickly checked by fear, which had now no longer my own, but his safety for their object. I watched his deportment in silence. At length he spoke. "Sister," said he, in an accent mournful and mild, "I have acted poorly my part in this world. What thinkest thou? Shall I not do better in the next?" I could make no answer. The mildness of his tone astonished and encouraged me. I continued to regard him with wistful and anxious looks. "I think," resumed he, "I will try. My wife and my babes have gone before. Happy wretches! I have sent you to repose, and ought not to linger behind." These words had a meaning sufficiently intelligible. I looked at the open knife in his hand and shuddered, but knew not how to prevent the deed which I dreaded. He quickly noticed my fears, and comprehended them. Stretching toward me his hand, with an air of increasing mildness, "Take it," said he, semicolon, "fear not for thy own sake, nor for mine. The cup is gone by, and its transient inebriation is succeeded by the soberness of truth. Thou angel whom I was wont to worship, fearest thou, my sister, for thy life? Once it was the scope of my labors to destroy thee, but I was prompted to the deed by heaven. Such, at least, was my belief. Thinkest thou that thy death was sought to gratify malevolence? No. I am pure from all stain. I believed that my God was my mover. Neither thee nor myself have I cause to injure. I have done my duty, and surely there is merit in having sacrificed to that all that is dear to the heart of man. If a devil has deceived me, he came in the habit of an angel. If I erred, it was not my judgment that deceived me, but my senses. In thy sight, being of beings, I am still pure. Still will I look for my reward in thy justice. Did my ears truly report these sounds? If I did not err, my brother was restored to just perceptions. He knew himself to have been betrayed to the murder of his wife and children, to have been the victim of infernal artifice. Yet he found consolation in the rectitude of his motives. He was not devoid of sorrow, for this was written on his countenance, but his soul was tranquil and sublime. Perhaps this was merely a transition of his former madness into a new shape. Perhaps he had not yet awakened to the memory of the horrors which he had perpetrated. Infatuated wretch that I was! To set myself up as a model by which to judge of my heroic brother. My reason taught me that his conclusions were right, but, conscious of the impotence of reason over my own conduct, conscious of my cowardly rashness and my criminal despair, I doubted whether anyone could be steadfast and wise. Such was my weakness, that even in the midst of these thoughts my mind glided into abhorrence of Carwin, and I uttered, in a low voice, "O Carwin! Carwin! What hast thou to answer for?" My brother immediately noticed the involuntary exclamation. "Clara," said he, "be thyself. Equity used to be a theme for thy eloquence. Reduce its lessons to practice, and be just to that unfortunate man. The instrument has done its work, and I am satisfied. I thank thee, my God, for this last illumination. My enemy is thine also. I deemed him to be a man, the man with whom I have..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.